Well, it's a very big day in US-South African relations, and I'm very grateful that Joel Pollack has stayed up until the early hours of the morning to have a chat with us and bring us up to date with the latest developments after South African Afrikaners landed in Washington. Refugees, some call them. Others, not so sure. Well, good to see you, Joel. It's been quite a day here on the South African news outlets, given that there's enormous debate about the 49 South Africans, Afrikaners, it appears, who landed in Washington. You guys had a reporter there. Did they feed back to you exactly what went on?
Yeah, we had one of our reporters there, and the families disembarked from the plane. They were met by some fairly senior American officials who came to greet them and who came to make a statement that the Afrikaner refugees, as they are considered by the United States under the definition of refugees, are more than welcome in the United States, and that it is unfortunately the policies of the South African government that are driving them out. And they are welcome in the United States, one of the few groups that President Trump has prioritized as refugees. And there's some interest in who these people are and what they're fleeing. In fact, we saw quite a lot of traffic on stories about the refugees arriving, and also stories and interest in the fact that the South African government is pushing back and doesn't want to consider them refugees and is deeply offended that anyone would consider anyone from South Africa to be a refugee and that they're not technically refugees, according to the South African government, which in a sense proves the point, because if the South African government, and I suppose portions of the South African media, are so hostile to these people who've chosen to live elsewhere because they feel that their freedoms are under threat, maybe that's why they left, because of the insensitivity to how they feel and what they're facing. So I think the American public is very sympathetic to this group of new arrivals, aside from the far left media like MSNBC and a couple of panelists on CNN. And they are the first of many to come.
How were they selected? Do you have any insight into that?
No, I think people simply applied.
Okay, so they applied, went through a process which appears to have been speeded up because the executive order was not that long ago. And it usually takes a long time to get into the United States.
I don't know. I know that the U.S. Embassy staff in Pretoria were very helpful, and people reported that they had been welcomed. And yeah, I mean, I think that the president took an interest in what these people are going through. And that's all I know about that. I mean, I don't know if there were any additional resources put in place, but certainly this first group, I think there was some interest in having them arrive in Washington to be greeted by American officials, largely for symbolic reasons of first group, which isn't so unusual. I mean, if you've, I have fortunately or unfortunately been on the first flight to somewhere, usually with an airline opening a new route, and you know, sometimes the passengers don't suspect it, and then you get to the other end and there's a party waiting for you on the other side. So you know, there's a bit of that energy, but I think it was important for the Trump administration to show solidarity with this group of people and to welcome them, and they seemed quite happy to be there.
Joe, we don't really understand the rankings of American officials, but the Deputy Secretary of State, Christopher Landau, and the Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security, they sound quite important, are they?
Yes, but when you can figure it out, I'm hoping you'll explain it to me, because we have assistant secretaries, deputy secretaries, undersecretaries, and it's very easy to forget which one is higher than the other. But let's just put it this way. These are senior officials that are at a level high enough for the Trump administration to deploy these officials to the event to send a signal that the administration is interested in this group of refugees. I mean, I don't know if it really matters whether the undersecretaries outranked the assistant secretaries or the deputy secretaries. The point is they had people there who were sufficiently important.
From a South African point of view, there is an understanding that America is the land of opportunity. It is the place that millions of people around the world want to get into. And I guess there's some skepticism here that the people who have applied for this are really just using an angle to get into the U.S. To get a green card and to get U.S. citizenship 5 years down the line is a huge prize for many people, not just in South Africa, but around the world. How would you react to that skepticism?
Well, I don't think that's true, but if it were true, so what? I mean, we've had 4 years of Joe Biden letting anybody into the country who managed to make it to the border or to overstay their visa, many of whom were people who had no real interest in the country, but simply were taking advantage of loopholes, some of whom were criminals, some of whom had been previously deported, many of whom instantly went on social welfare programs and started accepting government benefits. And in South Africans who typically emigrate, even if they're not refugees, you tend to have very hardworking people, people who come to the United States and contribute. I mean, my family's one of them. I hope to think it that way. And there are plenty of South Africans who are making their mark in other ways. And for a long time, South Africans have had trouble entering the United States. It's been easier to go to other Anglophonic countries. And I suppose the attitude is, well, if that's how some people choose to use the opportunity, so be it. But the executive order is specifically aimed at Afrikaner refugees. I understand that there are other people who may be eligible. And South Africans of all races tend to be very hardworking and committed and community-oriented when they leave South Africa and come to the United States. It's just that the South African government and institutions are unfortunately not set up to encourage talented people to make the most of their skills and hard work because of policies like BEE. And in the case of farmers, because of land reform and the threat of expropriation. So I think it doesn't really matter. I mean, if people are taking advantage of it, then fine.
Joel, you know the country very well. Is this the right way to change things in South Africa? You know, it's desperately needed. There are millions of us here who work every day trying to make a difference. Being antagonistic, is giving refugee status to people in this way the right way to actually get the South African government to change? Or from your understanding of politics, might it just harden issues?
Tell me something. If you're an Afrikaner farmer living in the Free State and you have the vote and you show up to vote every 5 years, what changes?
If you're a white South African living, sorry, any South African living in a city and you turn up to vote every 5 years and you vote, what changes? It's the same question.
Well, hang on.
Exactly.
In Cape Town, the government changed. In Cape Town, there was a change in 2006. And in the Western Cape, there was a change in 2009. And in Gauteng, there's a prospect of a change. I mean, you have these funny coalitions that fall apart. But if you're a farmer living in the Limpopo province and feeding the rest of the country, but the party you vote for gets 10% of the vote every 5 years, I mean, do you really have democracy? Do you have any sort of self-government? Mm. And do you have any prospect of seeing a change? Now, the other thing is, refugee status has managed to grab the attention not just of Americans, but of South Africans as well. Has anything else worked? I mean, look at how the South African government reacts to this and anything else, really. 30 plus years of this. How many more years must these people wait? And how many generations have to bear the burden of apartheid before things actually return to some sort of normalcy? And yet you've got an expropriation act that was recently passed that this family or these families who arrived and their children have to deal with. And how does a farmer today know that what they're trying to leave for their children is going to be there? And yet they're told that the land they live on, that they may have bought or their parents may have bought, is somehow theirs only because of apartheid or because of colonialism. How does one undo that? How does one go back to 1913 or whenever and tell one's grandfather or great-grandfather not to bother because you'll leave this moral burden for your children and great-grandchildren whose only sin really is to work as hard as they can to feed the rest of the country? I mean, farming is not an easy business. Nobody hands you success. I mean, yes, more than a century ago, people handed white South Africans land that belonged to black South Africans, and that's bad. But subsequent generations don't wake up in the morning and watch the corn growing for free. I mean, farming is incredibly difficult. And now South Africa is telling those farmers, we're going to take away their land, possibly for nil compensation. And there's nothing they can do about it. If they show up and vote, it doesn't matter. And they ought to be grateful that the majority population even allows them to exist. You know, to me, it's an untenable situation. And you know, watching the way South Africa treats the Jewish community as a member of that community, you know, I'm a Jewish person and my family are South African Jews. I mean, what do we do about that? What does one do? You can't approach them with logic. You can't approach them with reason or even international law. How many South African government ministers have objected to Hamas holding civilian hostages in flagrant violation of international law? How many of them have objected to the Red Cross failing to show up for these hostages except on the day of their release by these monsters in hoods? I mean, what do you do? This government doesn't listen. And so the only reason I think the United States hasn't given Jewish South African refugee status is that Jews can go to Israel. And so people can choose to stick around in South Africa and make the best of it. And I think there's an admirable quality to that choice. I think there is a prospect for change in South Africa, and I applaud the people working to do it. But for some people, change is not going to come quickly enough. So what else gets the attention of the South African government other than to say to them, you've counted for generations on the idea that the minerals beneath your soil are more important to the rest of the world than anything else. And so whether it's apartheid or post-apartheid, you can get away with whatever kind of behavior you want because the world needs your gold and your platinum and your uranium and whatever else. But what the United States is now saying is actually the most valuable thing in South Africa is what's above the soil, is the people. So bring them, because we have very successful South Africans in the United States. I mean, where I live at the moment in Los Angeles, the largest local newspaper is owned by a Chinese South African named Patrick Soon-Shiong, who came to the United States after training at the University of the Witwatersrand during apartheid, where Chinese South Africans were not treated particularly well. He found opportunity here. He became one of the wealthiest Americans there is. I mean, people know names like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and that sort of thing. But how about Patrick Soon-Shiong? I mean, maybe some journalists know who he is. He owns the Los Angeles Times now, and he's one of the leading political voices in the United States for change, and change in California, which is very poorly run. And, you know, in California, I suppose I can move to Florida or I can move to another state and so forth and have more of a voice if I don't like how things are going. I don't see a reasonable prospect for political change, given that we are also sort of run as a one-party state here, although Los Angeles is changing. But what do you do in South Africa if you're an Afrikaans farmer? I mean, what do you do? So I think for the people making the decision, it makes sense. And for the Trump administration, when the South African government has basically been obstinate in the face of all sorts of criticism, you know, I would ask South Africans to look at the trade deal that was signed by the United Kingdom. I mean, not signed, but essentially agreed to, a sort of framework for a trade deal. The United Kingdom agreed to a new trade deal with the Trump administration last week, and the UK ambassador was sort of beaming with pride as he stood there with Trump in the Oval Office or wherever they were. And, you know, if you look at the details of the trade deal, and I say this as someone who thinks that Trump's generally doing a good job, I mean, if you look at the details of the trade deal, the United Kingdom gave up very little. I mean, it was a very small deal. Not that the United States gave up a great deal either, but there was a great deal of fanfare around a trade deal that actually does very little. And yet it cemented an idea in the American public that the United Kingdom had taken a step towards the United States, and so there would be positive consequences for the relationship. The South African government couldn't even manage that. They couldn't even manage the smallest bit of compromise. Instead, they just told Trump he was misinformed, and sometimes they told him he was a racist, and sometimes they told him that they're not changing any of their policies, including things that might benefit South Africa, like dropping the International Court of Justice case against Israel, which is absurd and it's a moral stain on South Africa, or whether it's amending the Expropriation Act so that South Africans can be assured that their property is intact. I mean, the South African government wouldn't even do the small things necessary to move toward the United States. So it seems to me this policy is entirely necessary and proper, and that Trump's doing the right thing. And I don't fault anybody who loves South Africa for leaving South Africa to take advantage of opportunities when nothing they do in their particular corner of South Africa is going to make a difference. You can wait another 30 years, or you can make a better life for yourself. And it is interesting to me that the South African government is all in a twist about this, because maybe finally this will get through to them, but I don't know. So, you know, we await the next South African election, I suppose, to see what happens. That's 4 years from now, you know, and we'll see. I mean, I thought South African voters really chose change in 2024. And there was a government of national unity. There still is. But what has changed? So I think that South Africans deserve better and that the Trump administration cares enough about South Africans to try to change the way that that conversation happens. And here we are.
It's such an interesting point of view that you're expressing there, Joel, because quite often when one has this discussion in South Africa, it's all about, well, we need to get political change. We need to change things at the ballot. But the government, there's no question that this is a very incompetent and corrupt and very bad government, but it isn't something that is easily shifted. However, there is a move in the direction, in the right direction. But, you know, the moral issues that you've spoken about here, what about, you know, we have the highest rapes in the world. What about the people who are victims of gender-based violence? If there's just so much wrong in South Africa, it feels to many of us here that this is something that's been driven by lobbyists who've done a very good job, and well done to them, because they've brought the plight of farmers, and particularly Afrikaners farmers, to the international community. But there are similar plights for many, many other people in this country because of this really bad government. So I guess the question to you, putting all of that into your experience and your unique knowledge of knowing both countries so well, is where's the solution for those who have to wait 4 more years until they can vote this government out?
Obviously, the United States can't take everybody in who's dealing with a bad government. In fact, the Trump administration has ended a lot of refugee programs that I think were being abused, frankly, but fine. You know, even some meritorious ones, the Trump administration has ended those. And, you know, we can't solve every problem in the world. And look, we have our own political systems at times that are in similar positions. I mean, I mentioned my state of California. You know, we have, in a sense, a rich form of one-party rule that is dysfunctional. I mean, we have, by some measures, here in California, the world's fourth largest economy and still growing. And people come here, talented people, because there's money to be made and there are things to be discovered and connections. And it's an economically dynamic and exciting place, but it's becoming more and more unequal and the public services are declining. And eventually, you know, you run out of other people's money and you run into situations that, you know, I faced where my community essentially burned down because of poor public services that were not being provided properly by the city or the state. And the state's now in its second consecutive year of massive budget deficits because we've elected a government based on ideology rather than on competence. But you're starting to see a change at the local level in Los Angeles. We've thrown some of our incompetent people out of office in the last year, and that trend is continuing. But at the same time, if I want to, I can pick up and leave and go to Florida. And Florida is a very well-run state. And the dominant ideological group in California, who tend to be on the left and Democrats, they still view Florida with contempt, not realizing that it's passed them in almost every social and economic indicator. And, you know, that's where a lot of the brightest Americans, not just from California, but also from Chicago and New York, are moving, because they're given greater freedom. They have no state income tax and they're allowed to be who they are. So we have this internal process. You have it to some extent in South Africa. I mean, South Africans are flocking to the Western Cape, which is a place where political change has happened and it is run by competent people. You know, when I go to South Africa, it's always striking to me that Cape Town feels better than when I remember it 20 years ago, and Johannesburg feels much worse. The fact that Cape Town is succeeding tells you that it's possible that South Africans can change their society. Why this particular group? Because Afrikaners, for various reasons, including history, have been targeted, and they are presented both within South Africa and to the rest of the world as a group uniquely undeserving of sympathy. And it's because of apartheid, and it's because of what was done in the name of the National Party and in the name of Afrikaner nationalism. And I think people had a certain tolerance for that for a while. But now it's more than a generation out, and the majority of South Africans were born in freedom. And yet you still have this kind of attitude that Afrikaners don't matter. It's the one group that really isn't allowed to express itself politically, and that's under this constant cultural pressure from people who want to undo Afrikaans schools and change the curriculum at Afrikaans-speaking universities if those universities happen to excel and have good reputations. And, you know, it's eventually reached the ears of some policymakers in Washington who said, you know, enough is enough. I mean, I think South Africa's pushed it too far. I just think they've pushed it too far. And that's why we are where we are. I mean, it's not just the fact that there are influential voices and people who've been successful at presenting the case. I mean, when you say even a word like gender-based violence, I mean, what is that? What is gender-based violence?
Rape of women. You know, Joel. Come on, go and have a look inside.
I know, but it's
you
it's,
see
it's
what
the
happens.
Terminology that South Africans use, or which I would say, terminology that has been imposed on South Africa by a government steeped in bureaucratic language that is ultimately derived from Soviet era lexicography. I mean, it's the abuse of women. Let's use English words.
Amen.
The abuse of women. And that is something that is harder to talk about than gender-based violence, which is abstract. Why are women abused in South Africa? Why? What are some of the cultural reasons women are abused? And I know South Africans talk about this, but when it's abstracted to this level of gender-based violence, you know, it's sort of like, how does one in that position even begin to articulate what is necessary to solve the problem if you cannot use the simple English words that are necessary to address the problem? And so you're right. There are millions of South Africans who feel voiceless, but, you know, we cannot have half the population of South Africa move to the United States as refugees. There is this group that has been singled out, and not just for gender-based violence, but for all kinds of things. And they've gone unheeded. I mean, and look, I'll also say this. You have some very effective lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and AfriForum and other groups have done a very good job at presenting the Africana case. But you also have a very effective lobbyist in the person of one Julius Malema, who gets international attention when he holds rallies on Human Rights Day and says, shoot the farmer, kill the Boer, shoot to kill. And then your constitutional court refuses to take up the case. Now, we don't have hate speech laws in the United States. We have a much more libertarian approach to freedom of speech. And even under our laws, he would be arrested for incitement, because incitement is not protected by free speech anywhere in the world, including in the United States. To get up and tell a crowd of people to kill another crowd of people based on their race and their ethnicity. Now, he may not be in the government, but that's not a distinction that's easily made from abroad. And his party is in some governments in the United in South Africa. So people are attacking AfriForum and the Afrikaner leaders who've gone to the United States to make their case, maybe because it's easier than attacking Julius Malema. If you want my opinion, that man belongs in jail. He certainly should have been held liable for the hate speech that he's spewed over many years. And I don't think the day is far off where he is the target of sanctions and other penalties by the United States. But this is a man who is a genocidaire in the making. I mean, this is the man about whom future documentaries perhaps will be made, saying, why didn't they stop him? This is the man, like the Hutu power loyalists on the Rwandan radio, calling their fellow citizens cockroaches, who later were in fact indicted by international war crimes tribunals. You're watching it unfold. And so even if he's an opposition politician, or he's not the president of the country yet, he's the most charismatic politician. He has a following that appears to be sizable, perhaps growing, even though they didn't do so well in the last elections, but he has a presence. He is the most effective lobbyist for Afrikaner refugees, because people in the United States watch those videos and they say, my God, look at what these people are facing. And a crowd of tens of thousands of people applauds. And, you know, I saw that News 24, a South African news outlet, went after this one guy on Twitter, whose name I forget, whose only crime really was to recirculate videos of Julius Malema and point out that this is what South Africans are facing. And for that, this man was called a racist and his identity was exposed and his family members were exposed. And News 24 applauded and the government opened an investigation into him. And it was really to send a message to anybody else. So I think there's a problem in South Africa of a lack of courage in standing up to the absurd behavior of violent individuals who are prepared to say the most horrific things. And I think that, you know, if you had a chance to stop Adolf Hitler, when he was still bellowing in beer halls in Munich, I think it would have been good to do so, but Germans didn't. And at the risk of abusing a well-worn analogy, you got that in the making. So Julius Malema and others like him, and not just leaders like him, but I mean the people in the audience applauding this stuff. Also, Alec, and again, I'm long-winded here, but when I express opinions about South Africa on social media, I mean, I don't really care what people say, and I'm used to the hostile environment of Twitter, even in the United States. But the level of hostility one experiences from South African commentators is really out of the ordinary. And I've seen news anchors on South African television say the most shocking things about Afrikaners who are taking up an offer to resettle in the United States, that it makes it absolutely clear why they're leaving. The level of hostility among ordinary people and opinion makers in the media who ought to know better in some quarters is just astonishing. So I think the problem in South Africa really is a level of hatred that does take a kind of virulent, if not always violent, form. And that really is your lobby. Look to Julius Malema, look to the news media and how they're treating ordinary people raising basic grievances. And then you'll understand why there's a sympathetic ear in the United States, because we see those things as well, and they circulate very quickly on social media.
Very, very interesting point that you brought up about the media, about other things. But I'd like to try and end off on a positive note, if possible. I had a great chat with Jordan Hill Lewis, the mayor of Cape Town, last week.
He's a great guy. And although he probably doesn't want me saying so. Because I'm not so popular.
I'm sure he does.
Yeah.
He doesn't mind about that. And I said to him, what would you do given that you run the mother city, given that your interests are Cape Town, if there was an opportunity to engage more closely with the American government and to benefit Cape Town as a result? And he said, bring it on. So, and I'd kind of extend that to the whole Western Cape, given that there is a massive difference between the governance of the Western Cape and the rest of South Africa. Why would the Trump administration punish all of South Africa, not perhaps exclude the Western Cape? Or is that a pipe dream?
I think the Western Cape has to decide what its future is going to be. I mean, to take the comment I made earlier even further, when one visits the Western Cape, it is like being in a first world country. It is so different from the rest of South Africa. And South Africans know it. And, you know, there's all kinds of historical resentment sometimes. I mean, I remember being in the Western Cape in the early 2000s, and there were some people who felt that, you know, they didn't want to live in the Western Cape because it voted for the National Party after 1994 in the first election and so forth. It was not a liberated portion of South Africa. I mean, all kinds of nonsense. But the fact is that the people of the Western Cape have an accountable government. They have an opposition if they don't like that government, and it does run some of the municipalities, but basically the roads are decent, and you've got a government there that has committed to improving public services, sometimes by separating them from the national government and by developing their own capacity to produce electricity, to produce clean water. And it's made the Western Cape a really fantastic place to live. Unfortunately, the cost of living has gone up, but that's in some ways the price of success. And I know that I don't in any way reflect the views of Jordan Hill Lewis or the Democratic Alliance or anybody else in an official capacity when I say that the best path for the Western Cape is to separate from the rest of South Africa as much as possible, to devolve as much power as possible to the Western Cape and say to the rest of the world, we are not like the rest of South Africa. And perhaps to say internally to the rest of South Africa, if you persist in this direction, we are just going to choose a different political destiny. And we will be the South Africa that belongs to all who live in it, as opposed to the South Africa who belongs to certain people more than others, and that is run essentially as a piggy bank for the well-connected. And we just don't want to live that way. And South Africans are voting with their feet. So, you know, I'm not pushing the idea of secession formally, but I do think that if you're going to talk to the rest of the world, you have to point out, if you're in the Western Cape or in Cape Town, that you are different from the rest of South Africa. And to the extent one can separate the administrative functions of the Western Cape from the rest of South Africa, and in a demonstrable way, I think one must do so. And you know, the case I think one has to make to American investors is that if you invest in power generation or in manufacturing or other things in the Western Cape, that your investment is going to be safe from the predations of a ruling party that primarily functions as a patronage network and uses race as the excuse to help itself to whatever you've built. I think that the Western Cape needs to basically develop a different path and to market itself as different to the rest of South Africa. In fact, I would consider that for all of the branding of the Western Cape. You know, it just, people need to understand that it's different from the rest of the country, because the rest of the country is starting to acquire a very bad reputation.
Joel Pollack is a senior editor, is the senior editor at Breitbart News. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.